All right, back on the Young Turks. Jane Huer, John Ireland, Michael Tracy with you guys. We've got a lot of stories, including breaking news in 1 second. Let me read a couple of your quick tweets first. Sean Wilcox asks, if wiretapping accusation proves to be false, doesn't that make Trump guilty of libel? No. I mean, of all the things he's done, is anybody really going
to
follow up on that?
Could you imagine?
Could you imagine Obama sues him? He's like, no, I'll see your ass in court. And he wouldn't be the first. Haven't like 2,000 people sued him?
There's a lot of, since inauguration, there's been a lot of lawsuits.
Yeah. No, I'm saying in his career. Like,
oh,
he's got like 3,000 lawsuits between the ones he sued and the ones he got sued on.
And it would be libel because it would be via tweet.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it would be text-based, right?
Yeah. Let's see what else I got here. Science pundit says, it's like Game of Thrones where House, Senate, and White House are the kingdoms of Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that just sounds too good for them. they're mainly who's a bungler in. Well, we know that Trump is Joffrey. That is absolutely clear.
Right? That's true.
Oh no, what have you done?
Paul Ryan thinks he's Littlefinger.
No, Cruz. Cruz probably thinks that. But anyway, science pundit, what have you done? Are you going to make us do a whole Game of Thrones cast with Republicans?
Oh, we should update it. Remember, we did the cast.
Yeah.
I'm completely oblivious about Game of Thrones references, so I want to represent that faction of the TYT demographic.
See, Michael, always bring us diversity. Okay, diversity of thought. Okay, Rachel Pickett says, Joe Manchin probably won't vote for a Republican bill because West Virginia went for Medicaid expansion, so Affordable Care Act repeal would hurt West Virginia a lot. Yeah, but when's the last time a conservative senator cared about hurting his state a lot? Yeah. Now, Manchin is theoretically a Democrat. We'll see how it goes. Okay, and then on the journalism campaign, which allowed us to hire Michael as well as Nomi, $27 from Paulette in Ohio, $50 from Thomas in Australia, and $50 from Andrew in the United Kingdom. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Hey, Jesus, at some point, can I see tytnetwork.com/go to see where we are? Yes, John?
Yeah, I just want to mention that iPad's too big.
Yeah,
it's ridiculously
now
big.
Now it's gotten a little out of hand. Literally out of hand, like it's hard to hold it in my hand.
Exactly, you get tired.
Okay.
Okay, are we going to go to the graphic or are we?
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
Hey, look at this.
Oh, wow.
Getting there, guys. You're making me nervous. We got to make new announcements soon, but you will like them. Yeah. So 1,441,000. By the end of the show today, can I see 1,444 for 3 home runs, 3 fours.
Yeah. Still got a few weeks, but why wait until the end? Let's do it now.
And for our sake, don't make Cenk nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. thank you guys to everybody who donated. All right, let's go.
We've got breaking news for you. U.S. District Court Judge Derek K. Watson has frozen the travel ban 2.0 from going into effect. It would have happened later on this evening, but as a result of his order, that now will not happen. Hawaii was just one of several states involved in legal challenges at various levels and from various perspectives to the travel ban. It was expected those would happen. We didn't know for sure that it would be frozen, even if just temporarily, but thanks to this judge in Hawaii, that has now happened.
So I suppose it's not surprising at all because there's a ton of judges across the country and it's part of the normal hurdles you have to go through if you're a Republican or a Democratic president.
Yes.
And so I'm sure Trump will be flabbergasted by the, there are judges in the country. Why didn't anyone tell me?
See you in court, Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, they will. And so when they go through the whole process, I think this ban will probably pass. That's not a rock solid prediction or anything, but my sense of how they rewrote the ban after they finally talked to a lawyer was that it probably will pass a constitutional muster and the judges will, it'll go up the court system and that's how it works. And at some point the judges will probably say, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Right. Remember, judges are not concerned about policy. They're trying to consider whether it's legal, constitutional, and has followed the right procedure. So as I looked at the new travel ban, it's still the whole same idea. It's still demagoguery. They're still trying to get to the same thing. It's still ineffective. Those 6 countries have had no deadly terrorist attacks inside the United States. Even you take all foreign-born Muslims, it's 5% of all the attacks in the last 5 years. You've gone through all these stats. But in terms of is it legal or not, the president does have some authority to control immigration. And my best guess is that it probably is within this latest version, once they cleaned it up, is within his authority. But I might be wrong and the Hawaiian judge might be right. We'll have to see.
Do you think Trump will threaten to rescind Hawaii's statehood?
Well, does he even know that
Hawaii would be happy about that?
Does he even know that Hawaii's a state, given that Obama was from there?
Very good point. Very good point. He's been confused about this for a long time.
Suburb of Kenya.
Well, luckily, though, he does have his investigators still up there.
They're still there.
He could use them in this case.
Yeah. Another thing about this order, and we haven't seen the actual order yet because this happened just a few minutes ago. Right. But what this would seem to indicate, you might be right that ultimately it will pass. But remember, the whole point in issuing a second travel ban and doing away with the initial one was to get the legal rationale firm and justifiable. And the fact that yet another district judge is ordering this to be delayed maybe suggests that something more fundamental to the order is under scrutiny here. And maybe that's just the way that this is going to progress. Yeah. Maybe it's something more, intrinsic to the notion of a travel ban than we might have assumed.
It's possible. We'll probably, I assume, know by tomorrow when we have the actual text. Like, on which particular merits did they strike it down or at least freeze it?
Right.
I guess I naively thought that when that DHS memo came out, totally destroying the foundation, the philosophical foundation of this ban, saying that you really can't use foreign citizenship to predict violent acts. It's just not closely correlated with future acts of violence. I thought that might have some effect, stupidly believing that people who are scared of scary immigrants would be influenced by that. And of course, they're not. And the reason that I'm scared of this ban is, even though it's not as horrific as the first one, it's always been easier to expand policies like this than it is to get them passed in the first place. And people are most conscious of what Trump is doing during this early phase of his presidency. So if this actually gets unfrozen, goes into effect, then they might steadily expand its bounds over time.
Okay, again, it's just breaking news. We don't have enough details on the order. And so a president is allowed to be irrational. But the reason that Michael might be right that in the end the judges say, no, there's just something fundamentally wrong here, is because of what John said, which is, look, in law, there's a lot of times balancing acts. Everybody thinks the law is just black and white. No. So, for example, they say the government can do this if they have an overriding interest. That could be one standard that they use. Or if they have a reasonable basis for the law. But if they determine, like the Department of Homeland Security did, that there's actually no reasonable basis or not enough of a reasonable basis to ban people from these six countries because there's no evidence that they are causing some sort of grave harm to America, they actually could take that into account and then strike down the law. But then you're really taking away a decent amount of power from the executive. That's why I'd be surprised, but it is certainly possible.
And a judge would have to could take that DHS finding into account when he's determining the validity of this law, because what a judge has to consider in part is whether a certain law or proposal or action meets a rational basis test.
That's right.
So the DHS findings seem to undermine the rational basis test, so that would be something that would be incorporated into the reasoning of the judge.
Especially because it comes from the executive branch.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. What's next?
Okay, lots more news for you. Today, as expected, Donald Trump has announced that he's going to direct the EPA to revise Obama-era rising fuel efficiency standards from continuing on in the future. Now, this could come in the form of either lowering the rate of the increase or possibly scrapping the standards altogether. Now, if you're not familiar with these CAF standard increases, the Obama administration's rules, negotiated with automakers back in 2012, were aimed at doubling average fleet-wide fuel efficiency to 54.5 miles per gallon in 2025, although the real-world mileage figures would be lower for a number of incredibly complicated reasons. But in effect, it would require that they would get something like 37 to 40 miles per gallon by 2025. Now, that's basically double what we had not too long ago, and there's been a lot of progress driven by these sorts of policies. Trump does not favor them. Many in the American auto industry don't want these standards because it's a burden on them to develop new technologies. It also, of course, in many cases, raises the average cost of cars in the U.S. They make the case that it makes them less competitive abroad, although we already know that in some places you literally cannot sell U.S. automobiles because they don't match that country's fuel efficiency standards. So that undercuts that argument just a little bit. But after Trump announced this early today, the auto lobby very happy about it. This is a chief executive for the Auto Alliance said, "The Trump administration has created an opportunity for decision makers to reach a thoughtful and coordinated outcome predicated on the best and most current data." So they've gotten their day. They're very happy to potentially knock those down. Now, we don't know exactly where it's going to end up, but I doubt they're going to become more stringent.
Yeah. So two facts that I thought were particularly noteworthy in this story. Average fuel economy of new vehicles went up from 20.8 in 2007 all the way up to 25.1 per gallon today. So from about 21 to about 25, just since 07, just in 10 years. That's pretty damn good, man. Mm-hmm. As Bush used to say, we're making progress. And that's because the government mandated it. And well, the auto industry back then said, oh my God, we can't, are you kidding? We're gonna kill it. And that's why they all, oh no, they're all still in business. Actually, partly thanks to the Democrats. And so, no, they adjusted and they said your car would cost so much more. Has it? No, it's relatively similar cost. And by the way, they all have to adjust together. This doesn't just apply to American car makers. It also applies to the Japanese cars and the German cars that are sold here. So it's the same standards for everybody. And it's great. Like, even if you don't believe in climate change, okay, first of all, please get an education. Okay, but fine, whatever. It helps in a thousand different ways. It's less pollution that your kids are breathing, etc., right?
You spend now, less money on fuel. It's pragmatic for the consumer.
Exactly, which leads me to point number two. Now, to be fair, the standards in this case would add $875 on average to the sticker price of new models by the time it's 2025. 2025 is a while away. But $875 applies again evenly to all the car makers, so nobody's getting disadvantaged. But you got to pay $875 more. Now you're thinking, I knew it. Trump was right. Look at this money. Look at the regulations, right? But, and this is kind of a giant but. Consumers, I like big butts. In this case, consumers would save roughly three times that in lower fuel costs over the lifetime of the vehicle. So, yeah, you pay $875, you get three times as much back. That sounds much better, doesn't it? I know for me, look, you might have some cash flow issues in terms of affording a car, but overall, if you get the car, you're going to save a lot of money. Hey, I'll do the math for you. That's over $1,700 per car that you would save because of these standards. Yeah. Now, that sounds pretty good, right?
And that's just on average.
Short-sighted thought process that people have, like you were talking in the first hour. So, the thing is, then it comes with the assumption that everyone has to buy a new 2025 car. Just check as you're driving down the street, how many people have brand new 2017 cars? A lot, but not everybody, because they don't have to and they can't. So don't worry about it. Like, you can go to Craigslist, buy your 1987, a beater, it's fine. Go ahead, spend all the gas on that, run all the emissions you want, depending on what state you're in, and be happy or be upset that you spend all this money on a car that keeps breaking down or runs all the gas. If you don't have much money, you can't do it. But it goes to just, it appeals to the short-sightedness of our society now. Like, oh shit, $875 more? This isn't gonna work out for me. Yeah. And then they go in stupid land.
So you don't have to rush out and buy a 2025 car in 2025. But I would, because it's gonna save you three times as much. Yeah. So the quicker you buy it, the more money you're going to save in the long run.
Yeah, and we shouldn't, I mean, like that the auto lobby doesn't like it and thinks it's going to make it more expensive. That's both true that it will make it more expensive, but it's also entirely unsurprising that they come out against this. They were against seatbelts when they were first put in there. They were against the cost of having airbags. People want to pass a bill mandating rear view cameras to stop kids from getting run over at a terrible rate every year in the US. They say, no, that raises the cost of cars too much. This is the classic battle between industry and consumer protection. And in this case, it literally saves lives. In the larger sense, it could save our environment. Now, even the standards that we have right now, the ones that are supposedly far too stringent and all of that, there are a lot of critiques of those coming from not just the auto industry, but from the left as well. I mean, for one thing, you don't have to buy a new car. And so for those who want to radically reduce our carbon emissions, this isn't a perfect solution because many of those cars that are bad emitters will be around for literally decades into the future. As well, there are a number of things that allow you to artificially increase the fleet miles per gallon that you have. And there's various things in terms of trading credits and things like that. But even that's not enough for the auto lobby. They say that regulators should also look at whether ride hailing and vehicle-to-vehicle communication systems designed to prevent accidents and alleviate road congestion could be counted towards the industry's greenhouse gas emissions goals. So all of these things that have nothing to do with how much fuel your car takes to go a mile are going to be used. Already some of them are. And they want even more to be added into the equation in terms of how supposedly fuel efficient a car is.
So 2 points on this. I think the political calculation here is interesting because obviously Trump now views Michigan as integral to his general political strategy. He won Michigan by a very narrow margin. He claims the idea is that he did so because he had sort of unorthodox views on trade policy. So what he's trying to do here, I think, is trying to put himself out as this champion of industry. And there's no more thoroughly American industry than the car industry. That's sort of ironic because Obama helped to bail out the auto industry, and yet he didn't really get that popular conception of him as the champion. But Trump is now seizing that mantle. And, you know, I think it's because in the long term, he sees this as integral to his political sustenance. And then number two is, you know, why is Trump able to make these modifications or propose these modifications in the first place? It's because Obama couldn't get these regulations passed legislatively. He had to do it via executive order, which is always going to be susceptible to later amendment. So that, you know, and people warned about that at the time. And sure enough, if you get a Republican predecessor, his incentive is going to be to lessen these regulations. So, I mean, I think this shows the faultiness of relying heavily on executive order. It's good for the short term, but long term, it's not really sustainable.
Yeah,
and even on issues like torture, like if you say, hey, I'm against torture, it just allows the next president, and you don't prosecute anyone, so you don't make it a matter of law in a sense that way by enforcing it, slightly different but similar idea. Well, the next president can come in and go, now I'm in favor of torture.
I have a different opinion.
Yeah.
You leave it up to the whims and the discretion of the executive rather than entrenching it in law.
Yeah.
That's right. And so lastly, from my point of view, this. It is a very Republican idea because this winds up appeasing the car companies. Good, multinational corporations have been appeased. But also the oil companies, because now you'll have to buy more oil. Now, but remember, we told you it would actually save you 3 times as much money. So it's more, it's in a sense taxes from you, from everybody who drives a car. So it's a regressive form of tax that goes to the oil companies and allows the car companies to theoretically sell some more cars. Mm-hmm. But actually, oil companies gain even more than the car companies do. Because that is $1,700. No, actually, it's more than that. It's about $2,500 in gas that you save. You're paying $875 more for the car.
Yeah.
So the corporations, as usual, with Trump thinking, yes, but that money came from somewhere, and it came from you. And finally, to John's point, look, seatbelts, most underrated piece of regulation we've ever had.
Ralph Nader, what up?
That's right. And if you're Ralph Nader, you know, obviously a lot of people are angry about the 2000 election, yada, yada. But you can't take this away from the guy. He beat Richard Nixon. He broke his back and he, on so many issues, EPA, OSHA, et cetera. In the case of seatbelt, he saved millions of lives.
Yeah.
That is a hell of a thing for someone to do.
And see, a lot of other activists as well.
Of course.
He's the figurehead for
that. But he spearheaded that movement. And so
I'm constantly amazed at how many people still, to this day, complain to me about Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. The 2000 election. Like, they can't get over it. It's so ingrained in their psyche that they'll never be able to, you know, find release there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. But like Jimmy Carter, there's a lot that Ralph Nader just doesn't get credit for, even though it's right there, right in front of you. Like Jimmy Carter did peace in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Egypt and Israel were the two biggest enemies. He gets no credit for it. It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And let alone the diseases he's wiped from the earth, et cetera.
The guinea worm,
et cetera. But for Ralph Nader, I mean, think about it, man. Millions of lives. That's your uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, dads, and moms that lived because they put seatbelts in cars. And at the time, the car company said, no way, it's going to cost a little bit more to put the seatbelts in cars.
Yeah.
Who was right and who was wrong? So it turns out sometimes regulation is not such a bad thing.
Yeah, maybe it would be healthy for us to start to look at regulations not from the point of view of the CEO of a corporation, but from the consumers that they protect.
One quick final point on this. I think it's worth bearing in mind that although this in the long term may be bad policy, it may lead to climate catastrophe, etc., it's possible that in the shorter term, it could cause an economic a boom. I mean, not a boom, but it could cause an increase in productivity. Maybe manufacturers are more likely to, you know, up production rates. So, and that, you know, if that happens and it's possible, that could redound to Trump's benefit politically. So that's just something that Democrats need to be conscious of. It could be bad policy in, you know, in taking a longer view. But in the shorter term, it might end up being advantageous for Trump and the Republicans.
It might. I think that the chances of it taking into effect, given that they're going to, it starts in 2020, is probably less likely. But I see the point you're making. If it took effect immediately,
right,
then it could have a short-term economic effect.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is the reason why Republicans drive up deficits. Because in the short term, it helps them. And then they turn around when a Democrat's in office and go, look at these goddamn deficits. They got to do something about this.
And they're doing it right now.
But manufacturers make decisions based on projections about what the situation will be later. And that factors into their business planning.
Right, exactly. So if it's 2018 that this goes into effect, then they'll make those decisions today about what they're going to manufacture next year. If it's 2020, it might take a little longer. That's all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, and developing whole new models can take years and years.
Mm-hmm.
Very briefly, can you bring up a graphic for, just as a reminder, when we do these environmental stories in the background, what the stakes are? There's each year, the carbon dioxide growth in parts per million. As we have these little debates and we go back and forth on CAF standards, this is not just a linear process. It is, in fact, accelerating. There you have two standout years of growth in annual carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so this is something that perhaps we should take very seriously. Anyway, let's go on to what I know is going to be one of your favorite stories. A new study strongly links opposition to rising diversity within the United States with support for Donald Trump in last year's election. Now, what we have here is an academic study where several thousand individuals were asked a number of questions about what they think is going to happen as more diversity enters into different parts of American life in terms of society, what effect it'll have on business and the culture of America. And using the answers to that, they constructed a scale on how positively or negatively you view rising diversity inside of this country. And they found some really interesting results when you map that on recent political events. First, let's just look at how a couple of different groups differ on this measure. There you're seeing at the top the different party identifications. As you move to the left, people have a more positive view of diversity and more negative as you move to the right. There you see that Democrats more positive than Republicans, with independents right in the middle. Higher levels of education associated with a more positive view, although it's subtle, of rising diversity, and small differences between racial groups as well, with whites being the most likely to have a negative view of diversity. So that's kind of interesting, but that's not the most interesting thing. Let's bring up this next chart. So what you're going to have here, and I understand it's a little bit complicated, but you're looking at the chance on the blue line that somebody who voted for Obama would then go on to vote for Donald Trump. And what you have is, as you go on the left, it's more positive view of diversity. It gets more and more negative as you go to the right. And also, as you go to the right, the odds that an Obama voter would switch over to Trump based on how they view rising diversity has a massive effect on their likelihood of voting for Donald Trump, rising from almost a 0% chance to up to 0.5. It's 50% chance in that particular case. Now, the raw number of voters that this affects is small. There weren't a lot of people that could possibly be affected, but we are talking about a couple percentage points of the entire electorate. And I'll bring up the graphic one more time, that same one, because you're going to see that it's not just the Obama to Trump, the probably liberals or Democrats at the very least. You also have Romney voters. What's the likelihood that they'll go for Clinton or a third party rather than for Trump? Well, if they have very positive views of diversity, there's almost a little bit more than a 30% chance that they will defect from the Republican nominee to Clinton or a third party. As they get more and more negative of rising diversity, that goes down to basically nothing. And what you might say at this point is, well, this doesn't really seem all that surprising. All you're saying is that Republicans view things one way, conservatives view things one way, and liberals view things a different way. It's the classic difference between Democratic voters and Republican voters, but that's not actually the case. This is something ahistoric. If you bring up this next chart, you're going to see the effect on Trump voters. That's the red line versus the other two recent Republican nominees. Now, there is, for Romney voters and for McCain voters, there is a small effect in likelihood of supporting the candidate based on your view of diversity. But it is far and away a stronger effect for Donald Trump. Those who do not want the country to be more diverse are far stronger in their support of Donald Trump over and above how they previously have viewed Republican nominees.
And look, that's not surprising either, but yet a lot of people deny it. But the reason it's not surprising is because Trump ran the campaign based on that. He said, we're going to do a total and complete shutdown of Muslims, as one example. Mm-hmm. He said, we're going to build a wall. It's going to be a beautiful, big wall. I'm going to keep out the criminals and the rapists who are the Latinos. He questioned Barack Obama's citizenship, mm-hmm. basically categorizing him as an other. He's done that for a long, long time. So if those are the things that you emphasize, you'll attract voters who don't like diversity, who are opposed to diversity. Yeah. So that's why you'll have that Trump line that is much more stark than the McCain and Romney line, which I guess in some ways is charitable to Republican voters because the Trump voters dislike diversity more than a regular Romney McCain voter,
or it's regular a Republican factor on their vote, basically.
Yes, it's a bigger factor.
It's small text there, but they're controlling for all sorts of things: income, socioeconomic status, even views on immigration. For instance, this is not sort of a generalized thing about race. They control for that. This is specifically about the change in American culture and business that will come about as a result of increased diversity.
Okay, so I have some questions about the methodology of this study, and this is probably going to get me in trouble, but that's okay. First of all, I do want to note that there have been other studies that have come out that have found very different results. So there was, 538 has written extensively about how surges in Trump support do correlate to where median income has declined over the years, which does suggest an economic reason behind him gaining support where he did. There was a study by a British economic research firm that again showed poor areas were more likely to flip to Trump compared to Obama 2012. So, bearing that in mind, I do think there are elements of truth to this research. The question I always have is if you dig down a little deeper, so look at the questions that were posed to people in the polling. Mm-hmm. One of them is, people had to rate whether or not they agree with the statement. The statement is a bigger, more diverse workforce will lead to more economic growth. Well, for certain people in certain regions, the answer to that would be no. I mean, they don't necessarily stand to benefit from a bigger, more diverse workforce, and economic growth won't be what they experience as a result of that. So to take that to mean that they necessarily are motivated by racial anxiety, I think is a bit of a leap. Now, that being said, obviously racial anxiety plays a role here. That's undeniable. You laid out some of the reasons, the Muslim ban, et cetera. But what I worry about this study and sort of the memes that have developed around this idea that racial anxiety is more determinative of what happened than economic anxiety is, it's sort of self-exculpatory in a way. So if you deny that Trump's slightly unorthodox economic messaging had any impact whatsoever, meaning on trade, meaning on entitlements, I think you miss why he won. I mean, he did win because he was able to speak more directly to the lower rung of the socioeconomic stratum in the Republican Party.
I don't know why. I don't think that you need to worry about it. I mean, it's not about whether we choose to take the blame for something. We look at the data and we see what it says. And if it isn't showing that, then we can choose to sort of politically martyr ourselves. But we should, if we learn the wrong lesson from an election, then we can continue to lose elections. If academic studies continue to show one thing, even if commentators or pundits or whatever feel like that's the wrong lesson to learn, we can't deny the numbers. And in terms of your question about the methodology, it's a very good question. And these sorts of measures of various sorts of attitudes are a big topic of debate inside of academic disciplines. There's whole sections of political science that specifically are about designing these. So it's not about whether they're right that diversity would be a bad thing. Because remember, they're also controlling for socioeconomic status, whether you live in a rural or non-rural area. It's about whether or not that is a predictor of your behavior.
Right. I just question whether these particular questions are the best way to gauge someone's attitudes about the utility of diversity. So another example is, there's a question here, there will not be enough jobs for everybody. That's what people were supposed to respond to. And that may well be, again, true for their particular situation. If they're in Western Pennsylvania or parts of Michigan or wherever they might be, that would be accurate. And the idea that you're going to extrapolate from that they are therefore anxious about diversity, to me, it just seems like a bit of a stretch. I would want to see this replicated in further studies. And I agree that the data is important. I just, this particular inquiry to me raises a lot of questions.
Well, but again, so that was a good second question there, but it's not about whether they're right to be anxious about diversity. Mm-hmm. In your case, they're saying they potentially should be in some areas, mm-hmm. but they are. And that's what this is intended to measure, whether they're anxious about rising diversity. Not about whether they're morally wrong to be anxious about diversity.
But they're anxious about diversity only insofar as it lessens their economic prospects. So mm-hmm. they're not anxious about diversity as such. Mm-hmm. They're anxious about it because the effect of that more diverse workforce will mean they'll be left behind. So when the headline takeaway is that they're anxious about diversity and that correlates with support for Trump, mm-hmm. I think you're missing the fundamental reason why somebody might respond in the affirmative to one of these questions.
Well, but also, so the effect on businesses, they have to have something like this because they want to get to the economic component of diversity. But that's why they ask four or five different questions. There's cultural, social, and all that. And generally, you find incredibly high overlaps in answers to these various questions. People don't often tend to answer that they are very concerned about one and not concerned about another. They tend to speak in patterns. But very good concerns, and that's why no academic study can go on its own. This is going to need to be followed up.
And here's the conclusion that they reach if you look at the synopsis that was written as to the data. We find little evidence to support the idea that concerns about trade deals or a rigged system contributed significantly to a Trump victory. Mm-hmm. So to me, if that's the takeaway here, then that's the wrong lesson learned.
Yeah. On that, I most agree with you.
Well, but they're specifically asking people about that and seeing what effect it had on their vote. They're showing that it didn't influence their vote.
But that's such an amorphous notion, right? People express their discontent with the rigged system in a multitude of ways.
Mm-hmm. I think that's specifically the wrong conclusion. It doesn't invalidate the study. Now, obviously, I'm going to have to adjudicate here. And I'm actually going to agree with both of you guys, and I'm not doing that to be PC. Let me explain why I'm saying both.
Should we sing Kumbaya?
So if some of these questions are not great because they can be interpreted in a couple of different ways. I almost wish they had just asked the first one, which is, Americans will learn more from one another and be enriched by exposure to many different cultures, right? If they just asked that yes or no, people who said, nah, they're not gonna be enriched by any other goddamn cultures, then you'd have a good sense of, wait, is this about diversity and racial issues, or is it about economic issues? The other ones are really kind of mixed in between race and economy. It is possible that you'll think if there's more diversity, that's a great thing, but there'll be less jobs. That is possible that you would think that, right? And so, and I understand what you're saying, John. Either way, they're testing what they think about
diversity.
Fears about diversity, right? I get that. But and remember, keep in mind that these are some Obama voters. So like, how racist could they be if they voted for the black guy? Now, the answer is still pretty racist, right? It's entirely possible. But at the same time, you can't just conclude it's the racism, because if they were that racist, they wouldn't vote for Obama in the first place.
Well, and they're not saying that it was just the racism.
No, of course, they're not. And so
they're saying it could theoretically shift a couple of percentage points, which in an election that was won by less than 100,000 votes spread across three states, that could theoretically explain the difference.
Right. So, which then leads me to the obvious conclusion, which I think we all agree with, which is it was both. It was both.
Yes.
And so, that's why I've always said that Hillary Clinton's most accurate comment is the one she got the most hate for, which is the basket of deplorables comment. Everybody criticizes, oh man, that was impolitic. No, but half the Trump voters are guys who don't like the other guys, okay? And half were super pissed about the economy. So when you say the stat, Michael, about Obama voters were more likely to switch in areas where they don't have income growth, Definitely, that's the economic side. That's the economic side we kept talking about on the Young Turks. You covered even before you were here. We were like, pay attention to that. That's super real. And that doesn't have anything to do with the race. So it's a combination of all those factors for different people.
Yeah, so it's definitely a confluence. And I think basically everybody would concede that it's a confluence of factors. But this study, I mean, that one of the conclusions drawn is that economic anxiety really was not a factor. I mean, that's what they write here. I mean, I'll read it again. We find little evidence to support the idea that concerns about trade deals or a rigged system contributed significantly to a Trump victory.
No, okay. That is improper conclusion from their own study.
Well, no, we talked about one section of the study. They also, for instance, when they say that they don't believe that trade policy had an effect, they also asked them a slate of questions about what they think about trade, and they found that those answers did not predict support for Donald Trump. They asked them questions about whether the system is rigged, whether it's set up to support powerful interests. And they found, well, let's go to that actually. Questions about whether the political system benefits wealthy elites predicted vote choice, but in the wrong direction. People who agreed that the system benefited powerful elites were more likely to reject Trump. And so that's not the same questions that we talked about in the earlier part, but that's what they found.
Yeah, so there you have, and I get, guys, that this is, there's a lot of different factors involved here, because that's the real world, right?
Real world's complicated.
Yes, that's right. And so there you have a mix of what could be, and obviously we're all speculating to some degree based on the data presented, it propaganda mixed in with how your gut feelings. Here's what I mean by that. So the Republicans for a long time have been doing propaganda that the elites are perfectly good people, right? Hey, corporations are human beings, my friend, right? As Mitt Romney famously said. And hey, no, that's just liberal crap talk about the elites. Now, on the other hand, Trump did hit the elites in this election, so it's a little bit mixed messages. But the bottom line is, when your wages have not gone up and you're not doing well, you're mad, right? So somebody could come in and take advantage of that, of your gut instinct that things are going wrong, even if marketing got you to believe, no, the elites are fine, they're for the big business loves me. That's what I've been told my whole life. But God damn it, I'm mad. So it could still be that they're voting based on their madness, but madness. The fact that they're mad, but when asked that specific question, go, I'm pro elites, right?
And I think the issue here might be that this study is based on polling, and the questions are relatively complicated and multi-layered. So, not everybody thinks about their economic anxiety in terms that are easily relatable to polling questions, but then if you go look at the studies that were conducted in the aftermath of the election, those didn't rely on polling data. Those relied on median household income declining or rising, wages declining or rising. So you didn't need to rely on people expressing their discontent in any particular way to draw the conclusion that poor counties were more likely to flip from Obama to Trump.
But the problem with that also then is if you're simply looking at county level data, you're not running complicated regressions where you can account for other factors. And so that means that if you look at the county, you can attempt to say that this is the explanation for it, but you have dozens or potentially hundreds of variables that could be influencing the outcome. Whereas if you do the polling data, you have information about the person's income, you have information about their race, you have their age, all of these things. You can then control for those things and try to figure out the individual factors that are actually influencing the outcome.
Yeah, of course you'd want to do a regression analysis as a regressive.
Regressive you say left. That's going to be a meme later today.
The regressive left, at it again.
Their regressive analyses.
Okay.
Yeah, it's complicated. This is one study. There will be many. But I do think everybody, so I agree with you. I think that there are many lessons we should draw on from this election. And I am automatically suspicious of anyone who tries to say that there's one. Because that does not sound like an accurate reflection of reality to me. That sounds like someone trying to push a narrative. And so it might be that you take the conclusions at the end of this article and say, well, come on, like you have some data, but you're trying to draw way too broad of a conclusion there. And you're probably right. That's probably true of almost every academic study. But we should care about the data. This is just one little bit, but we just because it doesn't fit into a narrative doesn't necessarily mean that there's nothing to learn from it.
That I agree with. We have regressed into agreement.
And I'll end on a prediction because I like that. If a Republican runs thinking, oh, it was all race, so I'll go further right on the race issue and I'll be more racist, but does not mix in economic populism, they will get crushed.
So David Duke tried.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a little much, but like a Steve King, it won't even work within the Republican Party because they get that their real issue is their pocketbook,
yeah.
Right? And the racism is mixed in there with stuff they're mad about, plus the reason they think their pocketbook got hurt. If you take the pocketbook out and just leave the racism, I think it would be a disastrous political strategy for the Republican Party. But they're welcome to try.
That's true. And as we pointed out, this is just polling, but I'm a true academic. I believe that you can't just do polling, you can't just do case studies, you have to do experimentation as well. So I'm gonna be running for the presidency. And I'm going to run the most racist campaign you've ever seen. we'll see if I can get elected.
Well, you can pull it off.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And Trump really did find just this magic potion that worked by the slimmest of margins. So if you adjust one variable there, here or there, the entire enterprise falls apart. Remember, Trump's, the racial anxiety that he did stoke, that caused him to atrophy support among some segments of the Republican base, never Trump and that kind of thing. It just happened to be that they were concentrated in places like Manhattan and Northern Virginia and Orange County, California. So it didn't matter in terms of his overall electoral effect. But you know, if a couple thousand moved here and there, it would have been a totally different story.
Okay, you're forcing me into one last comment, which is that, hey, what if you took out the racism and just ran on the economic populism? See, now, then you don't depress.
I'm already working on an experiment. I can't do two.
Then you take out the voters that you depressed in those areas that Michael just talked about.
Now you're talking crazy.
If you run on economic populism on the left, this, as well as many other data sets and Napoleon that I saw, indicates that you would rock the other side. Yeah. Okay, but first you got to get past the primary.
Yeah,
where the economic populism, or I should say the Democratic Party, where economic populism goes to die. Okay, but that was the old Democratic Party, JusticeDemocrats.com. Okay, what's next?
Oh, we
got to take a break. Need some Lord mercy. Yeah, okay.
Unless you just want to push through to the end.
Yeah, no. Super quick break. We'll be right back. All right, back on the Young Turks. Let me read a couple of tweets for you guys. Other Bubble writes in, yes, go TYT. Got TYT to stream on my treadmill at the Y. They always have Fox on TVs. Healthy me. I don't know how you did that, but
plug
that's
in a Roku
awesome.
Or something?
Can we do a panel on like stationary bikes or something?
Oh God,
it's running commentary.
Yeah, that's when we will have jumped
that's
the shark.
Good, actually,
okay, but hey, Other Bubble, teach other people how to do that. Thank you.
Yes.
Emily writes in, appreciation for diversity is what allows humanity as a whole to progress. So of course conservatives hate it. Youth and Revolution says, this is why TYT is superior. You can never witness two corresponding anchors ever disagree on mainstream media networks. Too strong, or at least I think have an intelligent conversation about it.
Either or,
right.
We'll take either.
Jessica B writes in, I love the debate between Michael Tracy and John Iarullo. Awesome, expressing diverse ideas. Thoughts always expand our brains and cultures.
See, our panel is far to the left on that how much you like diversity thing.
So thank you guys, we appreciate it. And speaking of thanks, let me thank two other groups of people. People donating the journalism drive, $15 from Jane in Illinois, $27 from Michael in California, $27 from Jop in the Netherlands. Now, as a Turk, I'm supposed to be mad at you these days, but I got nothing but love for you, brother. And you just took down Wilders, whatever his name is, so thank you.
Twitter was hacked by some mysterious group of, mischievous Turks. I told you about this before,
but
it's unbelievable.
That was almost the name of the show, The Mischievous Turks.
Next time, sequel.
We were this close to that one.
Wow.
I was wondering if they were really Turks, because really, I mean, the ability to hack Twitter, but I read their tweet, they're totally Turkish. Like the ending is, you can't read this? Well, then you should learn Turkish.
And they hack such a random assortment of accounts. Like they hacked the NHL network. They hacked the Atlanta Police Department.
Network?
They hacked U-Haul. KFC, South Africa. That's just what I happened to see last night.
Yeah.
But they hacked something within the infrastructure of Twitter. So they didn't really go after individual accounts. I don't know what the hell happened, but it was bizarre.
I know what happened. They had a bad experience with U-Haul and they stopped by to get some KFC and that turned out to be shitty. They're like, we will get these Americans.
And if you don't believe me, I screenshotted
all
of them.
Don't understand hockey.
I screenshotted all these. They're on my Twitter account to preserve for all time.
Yeah, and it's such a Turkish move to be like, well, of course the whole world should be speaking Turkish. That is their fault, not our fault.
And the whole world should be aware of our like very peculiar dispute with Holland.
Yeah, such a random feud.
It is. Yeah. Now member shout outs real quick. Ryan Hayward and Hector Madrigal. So Hector and Ryan, you guys are awesome. We will do a post game for you guys. Who knows, maybe we'll debate more in the post game. I don't know. So the members, that's tytnetwork.com/join to become a member. Thank you guys for supporting the show.
And can I just give a shout out to the losers and the haters? Hello. Hi.
You're his Holland.
You're his Holland. Okay, now we're coming together. All right, okay. What's next?
Former North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory is probably best known at this point for signing one of the most controversial bits of legislation last year. That's HB2, that made it more difficult to fight at the local level against anti-gay and anti-trans legislation. Now, as a result of that, he is apparently feeling a little bit of financial pushback now that he's left government and gone off into the private sector. He's going to talk about it in this clip.
The LGBT, though, narrative is going to be, if you're a politician and you stand up against the LGBT movement, you're going to be punished as Pat McCrory was punished. Whether that's true or not, that is going to be a part of their narrative.
Oh, it is a part of their narrative. And they are using this 10,000 vote win as a warning to any politician to speak against policies which are contrary to their agenda. And they had one policy that was contrary to my agenda, and that is changing the definition of gender. And that's really what they're trying to do, is change the, let, instead of having doctors determine the definition of gender, they actually want politicians to determine the definition of gender. If you talk to CEOs off the record, they go, heck, I agree with you, Pat, but I couldn't say anything because they're more worried about the bottom line of finance. And heck, it's even impacted me to this day, even after I left office. People are reluctant to hire me because, oh my gosh, he's a bigot, which is the last thing I am. I'm actually, in some ways, rather liberal on some of these issues. I'm a libertarian on many of these issues. But I don't think a city government, a state government, or a federal government should be able to tell the private sector what the new definition of gender is. On the issue of gender, I think it's a well-established definition. You know, it's the doctor who determines the gender of a baby. You know, you ask the doctor, is it a boy or a girl? You don't ask the baby. And the same thing, should we have fifth graders decide what gender they are? I just think it's common sense. I'm a pragmatic conservative. Now I'm called an extremist and a radical. And this was part of their agenda. When I got elected, the far left all met and they said they're going to do three things. They're going to eviscerate Pat McCrory. This is within the first 2 weeks. We're going to try to get as much free publicity as possible through protest. Whatever Pat McCrory does, we're going to protest him. And third, whatever he does, we're going to call it extremist.
I love that he's saying, you know, they're calling me an extremist, those far left guys.
Who all meet together in a conspiracy against me.
Yeah, where was this meeting, by the way? I mean, they all fit in one room.
And I didn't get a call? I'm kind of pissed. I didn't know we were taking Pat down.
what I love about it is, I mean, look, there's the interesting debate about the bill, obviously, and whether he's a liberal or a libertarian or whatever. But that he says now, I'm having trouble getting jobs because I'm a bigot. So you can believe one of two things. Either he's being told we won't hire you because you're a bigot, which I find a little bit hard to believe, or he's just having a hard time finding a job, and that is the explanation he's concocted for himself. It must be because they think I'm a bigot.
Right. Oh, by the way, even in his explanation, this doesn't sound that great. Like, a lot of CEOs telling me that they don't like the LGBT community either. They can't say it in public. You know, they're just bigoted in private. I don't know that you made it any better there.
Yeah. Okay. And wouldn't they hire you?
Yeah, and by the way, they're also cowards, so they wouldn't hire me.
Okay. And what is the LGBT narrative, by the way? Has that ever been defined? Is it just like the more fabulous narrative?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know that it's ever been written down.
They're hung up on this weird, they want like equal rights or something, weirdos.
Yeah, I think equality is the essence of it, and of course, that makes them extremists.
No, but here's an amazing irony, right? So conservatives have engendered pushback where they do advocate for these anti-LGBT legislation, pieces of legislation because, or initiatives, because the business community is now against them in large part. So he's saying that the incentive economically is against these initiatives. So conservatives who are all about, letting the market determine what happens are now taking the brunt of that and being penalized for it, which is, that's just an amazing irony that, you know, this turned out to be a bad business decision for him, yet he went against the market in this instance because he had this ideological commitment to whatever, counteracting the LGBT narrative, quote unquote.
Okay, so that's the two main things I want to talk about here. First of all, if you were a real libertarian, as you said in that interview, or pragmatic conservative, well, what's the number one go-to thing of libertarians and conservatives? Free market! Free market, right? Well, the free market has spoken, and they've spoken against you. Okay, now you must be removed from the island. So you can't complain about the free market if you're a champion of the free market. Apparently, you're not valued that much. And you say, look, either John's right, they're actually giving you an excuse, and they think, this guy's an idiot, I'm not going to hire this idiot. In which case, the free market has spoken against you. Or the free market has decided they don't want to hire guys like you because they think you're a bigot. Well, that's the free market's decision. You should celebrate it. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of this that I find greatly amusing is here's a former politician who's like, well, what the hell? I can't get a job. That was the whole point of being a politician, yeah. Right? I did all these things, and then I come out, and I'm expecting my donors to deliver for me, and then all of a sudden, I can't get a job. What's going on here? Well, sorry, Mr. Corrupt Politician, that your payoffs and revolving door didn't work out for you.
Mm. It just proves that the market actually is not king for conservatives in certain instances. So when they have ideological commitments that contravene the market, then they're okay to buck the market, and then they don't place a premium on it. So that just shows that their ostensible commitment to market principles or laissez-faire, that's really only just contingent on circumstance, and it kind of undermines the argument that they've been pushing for decades. So I love the irony.
But we do, he claimed there's these extremist leftists, they're hounding him, calling him a bigot. We actually have some video proof of that. The meeting did happen, and he apparently stumbled right into it.
Shame on you! Shame on you! You anti-gay bigot! You're a bigot! You're a bigot and an asshole! Shame on you! Shame on you!
That video is so precious, man. First of all, God bless the guy who hounded him. I mean, that's as an American, you got a right to do that, right? He did sound a little like Austin Powers. Shame on you.
I did not pick that up. I think you're the only person that picked that up.
Every part of that video is Austin Powers. And then Pat McCrory gets stuck and he's like, where do I go? Awkward smile.
Won't open.
Austin Powers versus Dr. Evil.
That smile reminded me of the smile that, remember Tom DeLay when he was arrested and he had that mugshot where he had that huge grin? It's like this smile that you have to have in like the worst circumstance.
The awkward smile, that's right. And I can't help but make two more comments about his earlier statements on the radio. When you have to say the last thing I am is a bigot, don't say it. Okay, because apparently that's the first thing people think you are. Yeah. That's like when O'Donnell running for Senate in Delaware, Christine O'Donnell was like, starting an ad with, I am not a witch.
And I'm like, I don't know anything about you, but you're definitely a witch. And Trump having to say, there's no one less racist than me.
No one, believe me.
No one less anti-Semitic than me.
But the best moment might have been like, you don't ask the baby. You're right, we wouldn't ask the baby. We'd wait for them to grow up and be an adult and then make their own adult choice about who they are. And to a conservative, that seems like a clever argument. Now, are you going to ask the doctor or the baby?
This also reaffirms my belief that
he's a Bush.
Conservatives are most revealing when they're talking to religiously conservative media. So World Magazine, that's an evangelical magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Especially
on the radio.
Especially on the radio, yeah. This was a podcast, right? So I guess now it's also in podcast form. But I don't think McCrory would have been that forthcoming about his experiences and talking about how he's besieged if he had been on just a secular media show. So it's always interesting to see how much more revealing they are on those sorts of programs.
Yeah, they should go on those shows more often, as long as JR can record.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, luckily there are some sites that troll those to some extent, plucking out little interesting sound bites. But we don't know how many appearances they have that we don't know the things that they've said.
Yeah. All right. Real quick, I know we're way past that. Okay. Let's do the river story, okay? Real quick.
Sounds good. Early today, it was announced that the Whanganui River in New Zealand will be granted its own legal identity as an individual. The river will. That's the culmination of a nearly 150-year-long legal battle between both advocates and Maori tribes in the area. with the government, and there's been a number of elements of this, of course, it's gone on for over a century. The preliminary approval for this individual identity for the river actually came several years ago, but now we have not only the actual final agreement, but also money that is going to be used to protect the area. So under the claim settlement bill, two people are going to act and speak on behalf of the river. They'll work to promote and protect its health and well-being. The government and the iwi, those are the local Maori tribes in the area, will pick the two individual representatives. Treaty Negotiations Minister Chris Finlayson said that the tribes in the area fought for recognition of its relationship with the river since the 1870s. What's that?
That's amazing.
That has been going on for that long. It's the longest running legal battle in New Zealand right now. I would assume longer than in most other countries as well. They have another quote from that negotiations minister saying, Te Awa Tupua, that's the name that they have for that particular river, will have its own legal identity with all the corresponding rights, duties, and liabilities of a legal person. I know some people will say it's pretty strange to give a natural resource a legal personality, but it's no stranger than family trusts or corporation or companies or incorporated societies. And obviously we've had our own battles with that in the US as well.
What duties does a river have?
Flow, baby, flow.
Mm-hmm. To quote Mitt Romney, this is what first came to mind for me. Rivers are people, my friend.
That's the first thing.
Right. So let's just note for the record that you guys just said that the duty of the river would be to flow. Okay, so at first I read the headlines, and I thought, well, I don't know, this seems a little silly. So that's my perspective talking, and that's because I'm not a native of the Maori people, and I haven't been fighting on this since the 1870s, and I didn't view it that way. But when I read into it, especially the quote that John just read, I thought, huh, that is kind of interesting. I mean, what's more of a person, a river, or a corporation? I would argue neither one of them are a person, but a river is much more alive than a corporation is. So point well taken. And second of all, that's the thing. That's why diversity is interesting. Because if we didn't allow for that diversity and we just ran over this tribe, or New Zealand did, I would have never had that perspective. They do. They think it's that it's a part of their existence and their lives, and that it has its own spirit in a sense.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating. It's not my perspective, but it's a really interesting perspective.
Yeah, so the tribes there have like this very personal relationship with it. It's obviously a spiritual relationship. And so I read up on some of the history with this particular river. It's the longest navigable river in New Zealand. Has over 200 rapids. They're obviously very physically interesting in terms of geography. But the way that this particular river is woven into their culture and their stories about individuals and their relationship with the river is very interesting. And at one point, that was the area along the banks of this river is where the majority of the tribes in that particular area lived. And then you had colonization. And as in so many other areas, they were displaced from large areas. And that is one of the things that gave rise to all these legal challenges. Now, partly in response to those sorts of challenges, you also have monetary compensation. The current bill that just was finalized today includes $80 million in financial redress and an additional $1 million as a contribution towards establishing the legal framework for the river. The Crown will also contribute $30 million to a contestable fund for looking after the river's health. Now, in not too many years ago, there was a volcanic eruption. As a result of that, water from a local caldera, poisonous water, leached into the river, killing a large amount of the wildlife there. And so this money that's going to use to protect the health of the river is not just because of man-made problems. There's also natural problems sometimes that come as well.
So this is apparently a huge part of native cultures across the world, including here in America. We had the water protectors at Standing Rock who viewed that water as sacred. And, you know, again, coming from the industrial world or what, I don't know, however you want to characterize it, I think like water's water, right? On the other hand, making an argument that water is life is a far more persuasive argument than the arguments that are made today about how these laws are life. Laws, not laws overall, but laws regarding, again, corporations and incorporated entities and legal trusts, right? A legal trust is not a person. And water has got a much better claim, because look at what happens when you poison the water. the life around it dies. And they have a saying, the Maori people do, I am the river and the river is me. So they view it as personal. And if you're part of many different cultures who believe that we're all one, you know, whether it's the Taoist culture or the Transcendentalists or the Sufis, that makes a lot of sense to you. And finally, from my perspective, at least what it does this in practicality is it gives a representative to the river to protect the river's interests. Again, legally, that's pretty interesting. Maybe the river's interests should be protected.
Yeah.
And especially if, you, as a society, you're not doing a very good job of it.
Yeah. And obviously, very different culture here in the US. We use very different language for things, including natural resources. But if you really think about the way oil executives, coal executives, and the Republicans that they've bought talk about natural gas and talk about oil, talk about coal, and how important it is to our business and our advancement, our culture, how people's entire, like, entire area can have that one big industry. The way they talk about those natural resources has a spiritual component to it. And so I don't think it's all that much of a stretch, even if the particular language we use is somewhat different.
I'm certainly no expert in the legal system in New Zealand, so I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but I find it a little peculiar that there was no way to afford this river protected status without assigning it personhood status. Mm-hmm. Like, there must have been some fix available there without getting into this weird metaphysical territory about like what constitutes a person. And maybe it's just, and my sense is that it was done out of deference to this animism. So the religious beliefs of these particular tribes people. And I don't know, the cranky secularist part of me is just like, this seems sort of nonsensical. I mean, why are we giving credence to these silly conceptions of what a river can constitute metaphysically? Again, I'm all for legal protection for a river that is sacred and that has been very central to the doings of this tribe for millennia potentially, but I don't know, the idea that we have to broaden our conception of a person in order to achieve that seems a little weird.
So I think that what they're driving at is that the water is not as protected as it should be. And it's certainly the case here in the US and apparently the case in New Zealand. I hear you. I'm deeply secularist, deeply agnostic. So as much as I enjoy Taoist philosophy, I think Taoist religion is totally wrong, like every other religion. And so I see the water protectors up in North Dakota, and they're praying nonstop, and that's wonderful and peaceful, and I really appreciate that. But it's not for me. I don't believe that that prayer works. So, you know, that's our opinion. And so do I agree with their religious philosophy about the water? No. Do I appreciate that they fought on behalf of everybody's water? Yes. And do I think that we have our priorities a little wrong in society? And hence, as John points out, you know, when conservatives here in America say like, now, why do you think the good Lord put that oil underneath Texas if he didn't want us to take it out, right? I think it's not such a bad thing to balance that out with a spiritual argument in favor of water, because as a fan of ours just actually put together a video where they quote, I think Mark Ruffalo and Shailene Woodley, saying, I think it was Ruffalo who said, oil's great, sometimes you need oil, but you can't drink oil. Water's a little bit more important. So if this culture emphasizes the water, even in a way that I disagree with, ultimately, philosophically or religiously, hey, at least they won in protecting it, so God bless, if you will.
You know, it's one thing to be live and let live and let people have their beliefs. I think most people would agree with that. But now these kind of wacky beliefs get codified in the legal system of New Zealand under which everybody has to live. Mm-hmm. So that's where a secularist, I think, gets a little apprehensive about this. But then again, it's just one river. It's just about affording it legal protection, not the biggest offense in the world.
Okay, last thing, Michael, since you pressed on that. You're the judge. Is a corporation more of a person or a river more of a person? Go.
Wait, at least there are people within a corporation. The entity of a corporation is not a person. But
what
like
if somebody swimming in the river.
If there are people swimming in the river, no, that's a great point. That I think I have to take some time and contemplate. Maybe under a tree somewhere.
All right. Well, we will.
Another 150 years. We'll figure this thing out.
We're going to check back with Justice Tracy later to see what decision he came to, maybe in the postgame. So join us there at tytnetwork.com/join. All right, thank you, guys.
Kills me we're not getting to this rhino story, by the way.
I know. You know what? You want to do it in the postgame?
I guess.
All right, members, we'll see you in a minute. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.